Peter Camayo, and I'm giving a talk on coalition politics. This is the first of two, and I'm going to cover four basic things. Reconstruction, the populace, the CIO, and the present situation. Now, before this West Coast Vacation School is over, you're going to have heard quite a bit about coalition politics. In fact, if you look over the list of talks, you notice there's semi-emphasis on the question of coalition politics. And unfortunately, people generally have a rather schematic interpretation of what coalition politics mean. Most people believe it means is simply that you go out and support some Democrat who's a liberal, and that that is the beginning and end of coalition politics. Coalition politics is a term which maybe the words are not good to describe it, because it's a much more general phenomenon, a much broader thing that's involved. And what I want to do is go over some of the times when there have been mass movements, major social upheavals in the United States, and discuss how they related to the general question of coalition politics. Now, to define coalition politics in a broad way, it doesn't have to do strictly with electoral politics. Electoral politics is just one form it takes. The essence of coalition politics is the attempt of people who belong to an oppressed class, such as working people, Negro people, to try to solve their general problems, the problems that confront them, by seeking to have them solved through winning a section of the ruling class, or by supporting a section of the ruling class, or by believing that through their action they can affect a section of the ruling class. To have coalition politics doesn't necessarily mean you're in the Democratic Party. You can be outside of it and be for coalition politics. Doesn't necessarily mean that there's a capitalist around who's supporting you. There can be not a single capitalist supporting you, and you can be engaging in coalition politics because what the whole approach you're taking is trying to win a section of the capitalist class. And the essence of the difference between coalition politics and the politics that the SWP or YSA or the Marxist movement as a whole has always espoused is that, one, the Marxist movement seeks at all time to drive a wedge between all sections of the ruling class and the mass of the working class, to seek for it to form its own independent organizations at every level of struggle, and therefore finds itself always in irreconcilable opposition to anyone who suggests a program of towards using setting up some sort of coalition, engaging in coalition politics with the ruling class. Now, in the second part of this talk, I'm going to go into the general question a little more, because looking back in history, it's a lot easier to see something. It's easier to see when ideas were presented and then had to be tested in reality, and one can see whether they worked or not. It's much harder when one is debating and arguing over things that are happening right now, which are not yet proven, to be able to see it as clearly. And therefore, when we discuss the second part about today, I want to go back into the general definition and talk a lot more about it, so that we can place what's happening today more in the general context of what is involved, so we can see what direction, especially when we talk about something like the Scheer campaign, which is probably the most advanced in terms of trying to put on a left appearance of any coalition politics we've had, at least within the anti-war movement, and at least in recent times. And what I mean by recent times, like the last 6 years. Now, all I want to cover today, if everybody wants to go swimming, is Reconstruction and the Populist. And once again, I can't give you a history of these things. I mean, would take much, much too long. I'm just going to deal with certain aspects about it and hope to tie it up together in the second talk when I talk about the CIO and the present situation. Now, since the Civil War, there have been three major mass social movements that have created the potential of a political struggle against the ruling class, or have created one. Though there have been many other battles involved, and I'm not saying this is the only three times the masses moved in this country, but they are the aftermath of the Civil War, Reconstruction, the populist movement, and the rise of industrial unionism, the CIO. Now, let us look into the question, and by the way, this whole historic period we're living in the United States, it begins with the Civil War. The Civil War ends one historic period and opens up another. So let's begin by discussing just what happened in the Civil War. At the time of the Civil War in the United States, there were four basic classes that existed. There were the slaves in the South, chattel slavery. There were industrial workers, primarily concentrated in the eastern border states, and those scattered in every small city, no matter how far west you go or how far south, there were small groups of industrial workers. And there were the small farmers, people who owned their own plot of land, and farmed it for their own interests. Then there was the capitalist class, which was divided into two basic wings by the time of the Civil War. One, the industrial capitalists who based themselves on the development of industry, and two, capitalists who were either slave owners or whose interests were directly connected with the production of agricultural goods from the slave society. That is, primarily commercial interests, some of the banks. And in this general division between the two classes, between the class itself, was reaching an irreconcilable point. Now let me explain why that was. There's a whole series of myths which are taught in schools. And to try to deal with something like the Civil War, you have to almost go back and go over all of them. We just can't do that. But let me go over one of the big ones. The concept was that the reason there were slavery in the South was that the land was more profitable and the South could be run by slaves. The concept that the big plantation, if you run it by slavery, was more profitable than by wage workers. That's not true. It would have been more profitable to run the plantation by wage workers. Wage workers are much more productive than chattel slaves. The reason they didn't have wage workers, the reason they had slaves, was that in the United States, there was a fantastic shortage of labor. You see, you could not get someone to work for you for wages when all they had to do was move 1 mile and there was virgin land that they could take and farm for themselves. Under those conditions, it was impossible. No matter what you offered for someone to work for you, no one would. And in fact, all attempts to have wage labor work in the southern plantations failed. People would just get up and move. There's another problem, too. And that is that since there was a shortage of labor, since there was a tremendous demand for labor, it was very easy to strike and to make demands because you couldn't just fire everybody and hire somebody else because there weren't other people around. And it was trying to solve the problem of the labor shortage when confronted with the possibility of people being able to, for agriculture, when people could go and get their own land, that brought about the massive development of slave societies in the Western Hemisphere. The Indians couldn't be enslaved for an obvious reason. They knew how to live out in the woods. You made them a slave while they'd run away. They'd run back out in the woods and live. And you couldn't just make a white man a slave because you had a very difficult problem of identification. White men would run away. But if you took someone from another society, someone who lived in an agricultural society, was not used to living in the woods, contrary to all the myths about people in Africa at the time, and there was a clear definition as to who was a slave and who wasn't by color, and the fact that you had all the advantages of having uprooted someone and having taken them through the process of dehumanizing them, and especially the second generations, it was possible to create chattel slaves within the United States. But though this was still profitable, it was an extremely unproductive way to produce. And in order to make any profit, they had to work the land until they ruined it. Therefore, it had to be an expansionist system. It had to continuously expand into new areas. It had to, like the state of Mississippi didn't really become a slave state in terms of actually having any large numbers of people until the 1830s and after. The slave states began in the east and began expanding westward. Now, in the early period of the United States, the beginning of industrial capitalism had a coalition between them and the rulers of the southern slavocracy. through a political formation known as the Whig Party. And they ran it, and their basic class conflict that existed at that time was between small farmers against both the slaveocracy and the industrialists, and between worker and capitalist in the small beginning factories in the Northeast. However, as the slaveocracy began to expand, as the industries began to expand, a very important conflict began to develop. The industries wanted high tariffs to protect them from England and from other industrial countries. The South, based on agriculture, wanted low tariffs so they could trade. The small farmer wanted more, and the mass of the people that weren't farming wanted more and more free land. But the slaveocracy was expanding more and more into more land. And as the conflicts between the sections of the capitalist class began to break down, the southern slave owners tried to make a coalition with the small farmer to keep control of the federal government so that the political decisions of the ruling class would favor them. That is, they wanted the majority within the ruling class. And one way to create that majority was to create a coalition with small farmers. They achieved that. That coalition took the form of the Democratic Party in the days of slavery. That's why the Democratic Party became known as the Party of Slavery, because naturally in that partnership, the slave owners were the bosses, and the small farmers were the friends of the bosses. However, this coalition began to break down with the crisis in the 1850s because the small farmer found himself in competition with the big slave owner for the same land. Now, it's very important to understand the change in the relationship of forces that occurred. When this coalition began to break apart, then the potential of a coalition between the Western farmers, the Midwestern farmers, small farmers, with the Northeast capitalist industrial interests against the slave owners made it possible, therefore, for the Civil War to take place. Now, this might explain to you, in case you didn't know this, why the abolitionists, when they set up a party, called it the Free Soil Party. They were precisely seeking that type of coalition to develop, that is, to win the small farmer, who were the majority of the American people. The base of the American people was, and its traditions was laid in the small farmer, against slavery. The Republican Party was exactly that. And that's why Abraham Lincoln was its representative of it, representing the small laborer, the small farmer, coming into a coalition with Eastern capitalism against the expansion of slaveocracy. And it's this Republican Party is being created in this transfer of the relationship of forces among the classes, as the coalition between the classes began to break up, laid the groundwork for the crisis that developed in 1860. Now, the Republican Party was led, just as the small farmers had looked towards one section of the ruling class, the slaveocracy, now they turned to the other section. At both times, they were the junior partner. And the Republican Party was run from top to bottom by the industrial capitalists. They had complete control of it. And when the Civil War broke out, their purpose was to get national hegemony, to be the class, the section of the class that runs, that sets the laws, that runs the governmental apparatus, in order to benefit the development of their section of the ruling class. Their goal was not to abolish slavery. Their goal was not to destroy this other section, though that was inevitably was part of it. It just couldn't be otherwise, but that wasn't their immediate concern. They didn't care if slavery lasted another 20, 30, 50 years. Lincoln, as all politicians who represent classes, things are never one-to-one. You know, they don't have the exact same program as the class. He had a maverick idea. His idea was that you should do with all the slaves is ship them back to Africa. And the man had picked up enough mathematics in his self-education that he added up and found out there weren't enough ships to do it. And it just wasn't physically possible. But he hung on to the idea almost to the very end of the Civil War. The thing was not to emancipate the slaves, but to start a gradual process of shipping them back to Africa. Lincoln, like all people, all the politicians at that time, outside of a very few handful, and the Republicans were racist by any terms that we use today. They were not racist. They didn't believe in the equality of people. And Lincoln was very point blank about it. It's all a myth today about Lincoln not being being somehow the emancipator. Even the Emancipation Proclamation was a last ditch maneuver by Lincoln to save slavery. Most people present it as the day when, you know, it was announced to free. No. You read the Emancipation Proclamation, it doesn't free a single slave. It only frees slaves in the areas where they've already been freed by the Union Army, maintains slavery in all the slave areas, and guarantees slavery for any slave area that joins the Union. And what's brought about, if you want to read the details of this, read Korngold's book on Thaddeus Stevens and read the chapter on Lincoln and the Emancipation Proclamation as he documents the process. Where the radicals, the real radical bourgeois Democrats, the ones who wanted to see bourgeois democracy within the United States, were pushing to make the war an abolitionist war. So were other forces, which I want to go over in a second. And Lincoln was trying to hold off, and he was a very good maneuver. He was a very talented politician, and he was able to effectively not carry out a decision of Congress, which would have permitted the emancipation of the slaves much earlier during the war, which was pushed by the radical Republicans and passed, I believe, in 1862. In order to stall that off, he began his promises of an Emancipation Proclamation, and then refused to enforce the decisions of Congress, which required the Union Army to free slaves, not to turn slaves back over and stuff like that, back over to the slave owners. Now, the capitalist class tried at every point, you see, to make this a war, civil war, to end it as fast as possible within the context of not making it a revolutionary war. That is, not to make the shakeup within the society very deep. They did not want to mobilize the working class. They didn't want to mobilize too much the peasantry, small farmers. They didn't want to mobilize too much, definitely, the slaves. Therefore, they proceeded with what they called their border state policy. And in our books, this is presented as a very intelligent military tactic. How they were, by not coming out against slavery, were tempting the border states. Now notice the way they do this in history. They say tempting the border states. What they mean is the slave owners in the border states. But in, like all history is taught in our country, the interest of the ruling class is identified in our history books with the interests of the whole region. So that whenever they say the United States wanted to, always read the capitalist class in the United States wanted to. So when they spoke about the border states wanted to, they didn't mean the slaves, which outnumbered the slave owners 100-1. They meant the slave owners, say. And this tactic weakened the United States militarily tremendously. One, they couldn't win the backing of the masses of Europe, like the British workers. Therefore, it was possible for England to be able to even aspire to give aid to the Southern cause and to try to aid them in whatever way they could, because they could always point out to their workers that this war was not for abolition. Also, the most important and definitive military weakness of it was that it didn't win the slaves to the cause, and they were 4 million workers sitting behind the enemy's lines, who, if mobilized, of course, would deal a death blow very rapidly. In fact, the whole Southern army depended upon the labor of these 4 million people, which made up 44% of the population of the South, and which made up the bulk in the key areas where secession had been successful, to do their labor. And it was only because they were going to militarily lose the Civil War, and only because of the tremendous danger there was to the ruling class, that they began inching their way up to letting the war become a little bit more a social revolution in order to win the military victory and establish their hegemony. And they did it piecemeal. First, they allowed the Union armies to allow blacks to join it and to do dirty work, to build trenches and stuff. Then they found that they just needed more troops. And by the way, they found that, you know where you could recruit troops? The best place. You don't have to recruit them back home and send them out to the front. You could recruit them right on the front lines. All you had to do is send out a little expedition at night, go 20 miles into the enemy's territory, go into the first plantation, arrest the plantation owner, or just don't even bother with him, and just go out and recruit. Go among the field workers and say, would you like to join the Union Army? And recruit an army and set up another battalion right on the front lines. Now, any army that can do that, you see, it's obviously got a tremendous military advantage. And they began doing that. The first army they set up with the first South Carolinians. No pay, no uniforms. Well, I think they finally gave them uniforms. But they just treated them, of course, right away as secondary citizens. But by the end of the Civil War, 1/3 the Union Army was black. And the black soldier had carried out some of the very important key battles, but mainly had been able to, by once the black soldier appeared on the scene, the word got around, the people knew, the black masses moved, and the slaves could no longer be counted upon. And this began to undermine and completely shake up the slave society, and therefore it collapsed much quicker. But this motion, which they were unable to prevent because it was necessary in order to win the Civil War, was not stopped by the Civil War. And so we entered into a period that, in time, let's say it goes from 1865 to 1877, in which there was a general radicalization in the United States. Now, it's hard to explain this, but if you think of the fact that a slave takes a gun in his hand and goes and shoots his owner, has an inspiring effect on anybody who's oppressed by anybody. See, though it's unconscious, the fact that black soldiers went and shot Confederates and killed them also won them more respect and more support among white poor in this country than any propaganda, the whole work of the abolitionists all put together. When an oppressed section rises up and is ready to take on its masters and does them battle, all the propaganda can't cut across the fact that it shows that they have the potential within them to show an alternative, and therefore they attract to them all the oppressed. And so by the victory in the South, there was a complete new shakeup in American society as to what a black person was. Racism was in a downswing. The smashing of the slaveocracy was in the process of opening up the industrialization of the United States, and the industrial working class in the United States moved in a limited way because it was a rather limited class at that time. Even the talk of forming a labor party, they held a congress to form one. Trade unions began to grow. There was a general leftward turn, but it coincided with another development. That was that the minute the ruling class, the industrial capitalists, won the Civil War, they thought, okay, we won, now stop the whole thing. First thing they did was they sent their troops down south and they took the land away from Negroes that had taken the land. Trying to put a halt on the developing revolution. And in this process, they allowed the ex-slave owners and the agricultural interests in the South to reorganize their governments on the same basis that they had had before, through the Democratic Party, the slave Democratic Party, the same party, the same apparatus, to reorganize and to establish its rule. In the same way that when the United States went into Korea, allowed the Japanese to continue ruling after the Second World War. Same type of thing. The army goes in but allows the apparatus that had been there all along to continue as a means to halt. But as life has it, nobody gets their way simply. And no sooner had the industrial capitalists won the war than the danger of slaveocracy expanding into the areas of the small peasantry, small farmers, came to an end. And therefore, the small farmer was very much relaxed to create a coalition once again with Southern agriculture. And most certainly would felt perfectly relaxed that if anything, their danger came from the Northeast, from the industrial capitalists. And no sooner had they won, but then the whole question of bourgeois democracy was at stake. Could they allow elections? The representatives of the agricultural, commercial, banking interests now could win a majority on the vote again by appealing to the agriculture, which made up the majority of the American people. And therefore, a lot of capitalists became very radical. They began to find out that, my God, they were for civil liberties. They became extremely interested in seeing if they could do something about it. So the first thing they did was they passed the 14th Amendment, which was a very tricky piece of legislation. It said that though blacks don't vote in the South, you can't count them for representatives. And that would take care of cutting down the number of representatives that the South would have. Number two, they said, foreigners who come to our country can't vote either, that's true, but we can count them because they're in the North. So the number of seats the North got now could count all the foreigners, of which it was literally millions, who yet weren't citizens, but blacks who've been born in the country, been there all along, if they couldn't vote, you couldn't have representation. It was clearly a move to try to swing the vote, the representation in the national government, so the industrial capitalists could control it, as opposed to the agriculture. That was the main purpose of the 14th Amendment. But in doing that also, and out of this whole process, you see, though the capitalists once again just wanted it to limit it to this, they couldn't. Because there were social masses in motion. The only way they could get these things passed and get the support of the mass of the American people was to give them some social content. There was in other words, the social content was being driven into it by the motion of the mass of the people. And so the 14th Amendment began to open up, with the passage of the 14th Amendment, with its, not actual passage, but with the actual debate on it, so it began to open up a turn in the position of the ruling class regarding it. They began to realize that in order to assure their rule, they had to have the South in the hands of the party that supported industrial capitalism, and that was the Republican Party. And in order to achieve this, they had a very simple method. They simply gave the franchise to the Negro, made a coalition with him on the basis that he gets the franchise and that the joins the Republican Party. You see, it's this whole process is put into motion where the Republicans, on the base of the Negro vote, is going to be able to run the South. Now, got to understand what happened. They calculated the vote. Thaddeus Stevens used to get up in Congress and said, there it is. Even with this 14th Amendment, the whole bit, we're still going to lose. Either we give the vote to the Negro and assure our governmental control in the South, or we're going to run into more problems. So they voted to do that. And the Negro people, of course, supported that. Get the right to franchise. Now, the Negro could vote in the South, memorize this. Probably the only thing you should memorize in this talk. Negroes could vote in the South before the 15th Amendment was passed, before he could vote in most northern states, including New England states like Connecticut, New Jersey, all the Midwestern states. In New York, you had to have $250 so you couldn't vote. But in the South, everywhere in the South, a Negro could vote with no federal law giving him the right to vote. And he voted everywhere. There were more black people registered to vote in the South than whites in 1868. Which goes to show that a ruling class can do a lot when it means to. Today, they can't even enforce the laws. See? But when they needed it, when it was to their interest, they've got state power. Any class that's got state power can do anything it wants to do from these terms of view, legalistic terms. Now, a deepening radicalization then took place in the South because the Negro people didn't join this alliance in order to make sure that industrial capitalism had swayed in the nation. They joined it as a means to fight their immediate oppressor, which was the landowners, people who were hiring them as rural proletariat. And a class battle began to ensue in the South. Now, notice this dialectical thing. The more Reconstruction, as it was called, succeeded in establishing industrial capitalist governments in the South, the less the industrial capitalists needed the policies of Reconstruction. In other words, once they began to assure that their party could dominate or that their interests could dominate, then they didn't need to have the right for Negro to vote or to defend the Negro, you say. In other words, once they could achieve their goal to establish their hegemony nationally, it was not in their interest. On the other hand, the Negro people wanted a full completion of the bourgeois democratic revolution. That is, what they wanted foremost in the South was all civil liberties, all civil rights, and fundamental to any possible real gain of civil liberties and civil rights, a land reform. So long as the land remained in the hands of a small class, and in this case, it was no longer Southerners, it was primarily Northern bank interests and railroad interests which were getting the land, or which Southern landowners were now mortgaged to or owed to Northern interests. So long as they couldn't get their own plot of land and become like the rest of America at that time, small farmers, they could not be guaranteed that their rights were going to be upheld. Therefore, they began pressing again for land reform. Now notice this. Alliance is created on the basis that the old governmental structure of the slavocracy is left, which is denying civil liberties, the black codes, you remember that from school, denying civil liberties to the Negro people, and is threatening the national hegemony of the industrial capitalist class. An alliance is sown between the Negro people and industrial capitalists to resolve this, with the industrial capitalists wanting to resolve their hegemony and the Negro people wanting to win their civil liberties and to deepen the bourgeois democratic revolution. But immediately they come into conflict. Immediately the Negro people began demanding the land, and the industrial capitalists wanted this precisely to exploit the land, precisely so they can have a cheap labor. So no sooner than the process begins, but the two partners are now at odds. Now, an interesting process happens. And this hasn't been documented in history books until very, very recently. There are two schools, by the way, in the Southern history and Negro history as a whole in this country. One is called the Classical School, which goes up to about 1940. The other is now known as the Revisionist School, which started with the writings of Du Bois and Lynch, the 1920s, the Mississippi Negro senator, who wrote a book defending Reconstruction. It was the first one that took a different line. The Classical School is just a fundamental racist school, the concept that the whole Reconstruction failed because of the Negro. The Revisionist line is geared to fit American imperialism today. That is, Negro is really an American. Don't tell him he's an African. Don't get him confused about that, you see. So they start thinking they're African, they're going to want to do what the Africans are doing. That's fighting us. So now, they're brothers now, you see. And when you go back in history, we can't say now it's their fault that Reconstruction didn't work. We got to find another villain. The villain now, you see, is the white Southern racist. So the Revisionist School, and any professor you talk to of the Revisionist School would right away, you know, swear on a Bible that high that that isn't why he's writing this way. He'd have to explain why it is that simultaneous as the Second World War ends and colonial revolutions begin to spread, this whole new school begins to catch on. So that today there's no one left in the Classical School. They're all revisionists. And they are making money head over heels writing revisionist books. Every bookstore you go to, there's 100 new books on Negro struggle, Civil War, Reconstruction. They're all coming out, and they're all discovering new things about it, you see. But it's very fortunate for us, because in that we can find out some very, very interesting new information that we begin to find out. One of them is that the Democratic Party within the South collapsed when Reconstruction began. Because the whole basis of it as an ex-slave owner's party could not last. A class that's been, property relations have been taken away from it, cannot survive it. The power was strictly within the industrial bourgeoisie, and it permeated the whole economy of the South very rapidly. And so the Democratic Party, like in the state of Mississippi, literally came to disappear. And they reformed what was left of it, reformed themselves, and got together with some conservative Republicans and formed a party. I think they called themselves the Conservative Party for a little while. This all happened around 1868, 1867, 1868-69. But what did begin to happen was that as the conflict between the slave, the ex-slaves, and the industrial capitalists began to intensify, two wings begin to develop between the Republican Party. One saying, okay, we've gone far enough, we've got what we want, national hegemony. The problem now is not the Southern ex-slave owner or the agricultural interest as a whole. The thing now is to stop this process, to stop this social revolution before it gets out of hand, before you get an alliance of black rural proletariat with poor white farmers. That becomes the danger. And the Southern racist, of course, is waving this danger all the time. He's trying to get the industrial bourgeoisie to support him and to end it, especially those who have any interest in land, because they must, remember this, I'll talk about this labor shortage. They must have the Negro not being able to free to move out. There was still free land in the West. There was enough free land. Let me tell you something. Memorize this fact too. If they just expropriated the 70,000 big slave owners, okay, that would have been 390 million acres. And if they'd given 40 acres per Negro family, that would have used up only 1/9 of that land. Not only that, there was enough land in the South. There was 46 million acres owned by the government. So 40 acres could have been given to every Negro family in the South just on public land. So it's the capitalist, industrial capitalists who stopped the land reform. They're the ones who can't have it. You see, they're the ones who oppose it. Because even if they own public land, if they just opened up the public lands, it's true they wouldn't be expropriating their own land, but then who would work it? Where would they get their working class? And go back into the literature of that time and you'll see article upon article upon article, where can we get workers? And they started all their experiments. They brought them from Ireland. They sent them to Alabama. They went to China. And they calculated everything. And when they got through calculating, they said the cheapest way is to keep the black man down. The Irish, by the way, were a big problem for them because they got them down there, and the first time it came to collect the crop, they went on strike. And since cotton had to be collected, or it'd go bad in something like 5 days, they had to capitulate, and they tripled their wages. And of course, that type of concept began to spread, you see. So the question of civil liberties now is directly tied into the question of the standard of living of the working class and what was going to happen to the black people in the South. And in order to exploit and take advantage of the South, Reconstruction had to be called to a halt. And the ruling class begins to divide. The Democratic Party, as we know it today, in the South, was founded by the conservative wing of the Republican Party. That became its leaders, that became its backbone, and that became the political program of the party in the South. Now, they called upon an interesting tradition in setting up this party, the traditions of the slave Democratic Party, which was racism and just general backwardness, just general ignorance, barbarism, and began preparing a counter-revolution within the South against Reconstruction. And more of the industrial capitalist class began to switch. Naturally, the hoodlum element, the lumpen element, which existed in quite large numbers in the South at that time among whites who had been part of the slave system, were excellent recruits for the dirty work of the now new party that was being built, rebuilt in a sense, the Democratic Party. And they began forming armed underground units directly connected with the party. Everywhere they build a Democratic Party chapter, they build an armed body. In our history books, they talk about the Ku Klux Klan, and they only feature the Ku Klux Klan for a very special reason. The Ku Klux Klan was an armed body of men that existed just after the Civil War of ex-slave owners types, and then was dissolved at the same time the Democratic Party dissolved. They don't talk about the much larger, much more massive terrorist groups that were exactly like the Klan, based themselves on the structure of the Klan, and even in some cases were the reorganization of the Klan, but which were organized by the new Democratic Party after 1868, such as the White Camellia, the Red Shirts, had a whole series, most of them were known as the Democratic Rifle Clubs. And all over the South, literal class war in terms of actual shooting began to develop. The Negro people counted on their ally. They began to fight it legalistically. They had representatives within all the governments in the South. The Republicans was their party, their ally. And I'll give you an example. They demanded that militias be set up to defend the rights of the citizenry. And the governments would say, okay, we want a militia. And the South, the Northern federal government would say, well, we'll send you guns sometime, we'll get around to it. Meanwhile, this Democratic Party is building up this massive army. Now let me just give you two quick cases because I want to get off this and deal with another aspect of Reconstruction. Let me take Mississippi and South Carolina. In both cases, the Negroes had a majority, could not lose an election. Mississippi, it came to an open confrontation. The white rifle clubs of the Democratic Party armed themselves, and the Negro people formed militias. Legal militias passed by their legislature, democratically elected. And they were literally facing each other for battle. When General Grant came to the rescue and sent his representative to Mississippi. Representative came on the scene and said, well, we must have a compromise. We've got to settle this. And when they got through with all the talk and all the dealings, the Negroes were disarmed by the federal troops standing by, and the Democratic Party military machine wasn't touched. There was an election that year. Guess who won? And in that process, hundreds and hundreds of Negro militants and radical leaders throughout Mississippi were assassinated. A terror campaign began and swept the South as they began to smash Reconstruction through force. In South Carolina, the Negro voter outnumbered the white voter 90,000 to 60,000. Couldn't lose. Just impossible. And it was only through terror that they were able to stop it. But even so, in the case of South Carolina, the blacks won the election. The whites contested it, the Democratic Party contested it, and they took it before Governor Hayes, President Hayes. He, of course, sided with the Democrats. And so ended Reconstruction. Now, key to this, and I don't want to go into whether it would have been possible to stop it in a historic sense and so forth, that's very complicated, but key to this was that in mobilizing the poor whites against the Negro, the Democratic Party, as it was reorganized in the South, took on a very important aspect to it. And that is was the, the party of demagoguery. It approached the poor whites on the basis that it was for them as agricultural workers against industrial capitalism. And its cry began, drive the Northerners out, drive the carpetbaggers out, put the South back in the hands of the Southerners. But that party was controlled from top to bottom by Northerners. And there are two very well written, excellent articles by myself and the Young Socialists that discuss this at length. And I want to just give you an example of who the people who came in. If I get the right one, I'll hand it. Let me just give you an example of who these Southern Redemption governments that established Southern, pick at any history book and look up the Redemption period, and they all say South was returned to Southern rule. See? And the Southerners didn't like Reconstruction. It's true, the Negroes got a raw deal in it, but the South was back in the hands of Southerners. And that whole demagoguery approach, in order to win the small white farmer in the South on the basis of racism, laid a certain approach in the whole role that the Democratic Party was to play in that next period, unlike the Republican Party, which was known as the Party of Industrial Capitalism. Okay, in Mississippi, the two first governors were Stone and Lowry. Both of them were railroad lawyers. In Tennessee, John Brown was the first Redemption governor. He was vice president of the Texas and Pacific Railroad, later president of the Bonnie Air Company. The next one was John Porter. He was president of Nashville, Chattanooga, and St. Louis Railroad Company. You notice the railroads dominate all these governments. In Alabama, George S. Houston, the first governor, director of the branch of the Louisville and National Railroad Company. Ralph S. Cobb followed Huston as governor, attorney for the Louisville and National Railroad. In Georgia, Georgia is the classical example where they say the Southerners came back to rule. And they always said that because there were three guys who ran Georgia for about 20 years after Redemption, who were all beautiful examples of the South. And probably the best of them was John B. Gordon, who was the general in command of the ex-Confederate troops. You know, they formed their, what do you call them, the Veterans Organization, the Veterans of the Civil War Southerners. He was the leader of the Ku Klux Klan of the state of Georgia. And he had been an ex-Confederate, he was a Confederate general. So there was a perfect Southerner. He was also on the payroll of the Louisville and Nashville Railroad for $14,000 a year. The other member was John Joseph Brown. He was president of the Western Atlantic Railroad Company, part owner of the Southern Railroad and Steamship Company. And he's also had some money in iron. And the third one was Alfred Colquitt, who was a plantation owner, but also had money invested in fertilizer factories and in coal mining. So that what you have in the South is not a return of the plantationers. And by the way, I'll just throw this in for a sidelight. Go read the CP's interpretation of Reconstruction in James Allen's book, The Fight for Democracy. And if you read that, you would think that the ex-slave owners literally rose again as slave owners and took over. He puts a label on them, bourbons, and from then on, he's got his coalition politics, you see, worked out. There's the bad capitalists, they're called bourbons. And there's the not too bad capitalists, who sometimes can be won over, called the non-bourbons. And so you have the good bad guy within the ruling class. But history, as these revisionists have been documenting, not meaning to, they're showing that there wasn't any bad or good guy, that it was the class as a whole, and especially its most so-called progressive section, the industrial capitalists, who finished Reconstruction. And the Negro people attempted to struggle from within the Republican Party, within this coalition, and it was precisely there that they got their betrayal. It's precisely within that coalition, the fact that there was no independent force of the working class, Negro people, or the peasantry at that time, that made it impossible for them to stop the wave of reaction. And the results were devastating for the Negro people. Now, the success of the Democratic Party's demagoguery approach to the small farmer in the South was an absolute smashing success. It set in a period of reaction. As far as the Negro people was concerned, that wasn't broken or even turned around until at least the rise of the CIO in the beginning of the Second World War. From then on, it was straight down, step by step, and there was no easing of the picture. until the turn of relationship of forces which takes place at the time of the rise of the CIO. Now, that's one example and gives you the idea, begins to explain why the Democratic Party is so different from the Republican Party. But the Democratic Party passed its supreme test in its role as the party that approaches and takes in any opposing motion against the ruling class and is able to therefore kill it. It was proven when the small farmers, as industrial capitalism developed in this country, began to naturally be driven down. They were historically gone. You could not force capitalism back into small businesses. Monopolies were developing. That's progress. The thing to do, of course, is take over the monopolies. They wanted to cut them up again. Can't go back in history. But nevertheless, the populist movement was an outburst of the small farmer against the development of monopoly capital.